the show.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, back from Europe. Very excited to be back in the States, though I had a great time there, and I know that y'all benefited from the massive amounts of recording. Can I repeat that? Massive. That we did prior to my departure almost did me in. I'm sure I just got some kind of, you know, I lost a few years off my life as a result of that. But it is great to be back in front of the mic chit-chatting with you all. And I'm going to actually talk on today's show a little bit about my experience in Europe. And I have two friends here to join me in that. Before we get started, letting you know that we're going to feature an interview from David Clark. He is an author and a really like a marriage counselor, and I'm going to be honest, sex therapist. we're going to be featuring an interview with him as our culture segment. And when I first interviewed him, I was like, I saw the stuff and I'm like, should we be talking with a sex therapist on Boundless? But I was like, you know what? We're going to do it. And then Q&A with our own Glenn Stanton here at Focus on the Family. He's one of our marriage and family experts and researchers, and you will enjoy that. But right now I want to introduce two guys, Ben Robb and Matthew John. Welcome, guys.
Hello, thank you.
What is up?
So, okay, you guys probably know, and by you, I mean all you out there, you probably remember Ben from our webcast. He came in, figured I needed to bring him in again because of his amazing accent. but he is part of our donor ministry area here at Focus on the Family, working with, tell us a little bit about what you do, Ben.
Sure, yeah, we specifically, I'm on the foundations team, so we're visiting with private foundations, just developing those relationships a little bit, you know, talking about what we do, talking about what they're passionate about, and seeing where there's opportunity for partnership in ministry.
Yeah, that's cool. I've often talked to people before when you sit around with people and you say, what would your ideal job be? I remember one of my friends said he'd love to like lead a foundation or have a, you know, to be able to make those kind of decisions. So, and you get to go out and talk to them.
Right, exactly. And the folks with foundations, they're really neat. They're intentional about their giving. You know, they've got a great pulse on the philanthropic community, what the needs are out there. So it's a neat community to be interacting with.
Yeah, that's cool. And then Matthew, you, a lot of the Boundless folks have known you, especially through your involvement with the Focus Leadership Institute and True You in the past. But you are now, have been blogging for Boundless, and I saw your little Alaska.
Twice now.
Well, you know, we'll read over what you wrote and see if it's, you know, acceptable and start to see what happens. But I did look at your photos and your Alaska experiences and your references to Narnia. That was fantastic. And more so looking at the comments, because I think they were about 99% from women who were like, you're so amazing and all your stuff that you've done in Alaska. It's just so amazing.
I totally have them fooled.
So they get to hear your voice. Look at that. They get to connect with you so soon.
They get to realize that I'm not nearly as bubbly in person as I sound in print. So there we go.
Well, that's good. It's a good balance. You know, just you don't want to be all too crazy or anything. No. So, well, I brought these guys in because I did want to give you guys a little recap on my time in Europe. Obviously, I promised that on the front end, but really, I mean, an amazing, amazing time. And I want to talk to these guys, obviously, Ben, because he lived there in the UK. Matthew's done a bunch of missions trips and, you know, kind of is in our demographic. And I think it was neat for me. I mean, everyone says, you know, well, how was your trip? And I'm sure it was once in a lifetime and stuff like that. And it was. But it was a great mix of just fun stuff and going to fun places and being completely overwhelmed by the amount of history and everything else that was going on. But at the same time, just really connecting with people over there as well and getting a little glimpse into, wow, not only how does this culture differ from the one I'm used to, but when I looked at things that, you know, were spiritual and looking at the condition of the churches over there and the church, big C, and talking with other believers. Those of you who are out there who were at the London meetup, hello. I'm going to mention you guys as well. So, let me just start by saying, here's what happened. I went to Norway for 9 days, family reunion, great time in Norway, and it's beautiful. Norway has the highest standard of living in the world, so, and they know it. They got a lot of oil. Minimum wage there is about $22 US equivalent. And
I'm going to move to Norway.
Exactly. Well, I don't know if you can, though. I think you have to be now, like, they're shutting people out. So you have to prove, like, Norwegian descent or something. That's what's so my some of my family is like, let's go over there. Really wanted to bring my mom because this is her side of the family, but she flat out told me, you know what, I don't want to go over there, have a heart attack, and end up in a socialist medical system. So that's just how she rolls. That was her experience of it.
I'm rolling my eyes right now.
Ben's rolling his eyes. But she's 81, so she just has her little opinions. So anyway, so went over there and was there, like I said, for a family reunion. So a big contingent of Norwegians. And then some of us from the States as well, and did a lot of hiking while I was over there. For those of you who follow me on Facebook, you know that I got bit by a tick and got Lyme disease, because that is the story of my life. I do not get colds. I get chronic illnesses for which there is no cure. So
you look like you're doing pretty well now. So you just have no symptoms at all?
No, and that's the good thing, because apparently I caught it early enough. So even though I didn't really do anything until a month in, but I did not have a headache or fever or anything. Once you get that, then it becomes systemic, and then you're doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So they think that 2 weeks of antibiotics is going to knock this out. Lord, make it so. Anyway, there we have that.
At least you can still sing.
So. I can still sing for now. Here are a couple other funny things about Norway. There are only 4.5 million people there. They call Southern Norway the Bible Belt because any person who remotely identifies himself as a Christian lives in Southern Norway, apparently.
All three of them.
All three of them. Oslo, I heard, has like a 30-40% percentage of folks who even acknowledge the existence of God. So high atheism percentage up there. But they're very, very low crime, you know. So it's a very just like you go down the street and you might be walking and going into a store or going, say you're even going into a mall. Here's something that happens in Norway. You'll just walk in there and there are like baby carriages with babies in them lined up outside. Like women leave their babies unattended and go in and shop and come out and pick their baby
just
up.
Just sitting there.
Just sitting there. And apparently several years ago, a Norwegian woman did that in Manhattan and got arrested. But I mean, it's totally acceptable in Norway and I couldn't even believe it. So anyway, did that. Anyway, you can, you know, hit me up on Facebook if you want more details about that. But then from there, my sister and I flew to the UK. We flew into Heathrow and were in London a total of about 4.5 days and then did a tour of England and Scotland, which was fantastic. And on one of our last days there, back in London, we did a Boundless meetup. I think there were about 20 friends, Boundless fans from London and nearby who came to that. And we met kind of at a pub down on the Thames, and I just got to chit chat with everyone. I think we have some photos. I think someone tagged me in some on my page, so you can see them there. But also one of our Boundless friends, hey Chiz, works in the BT Tower in London, and she got passes for us to go up to the top and do that.
Have fun.
Look around there. But Ben, I want to start with you because you are from England originally.
Yes.
And I mean, how you obviously have done, well, now you live here, obviously, but you've kind of done the reverse and gone from growing up in England to now being part of the States. What do you see as like the core differences, either just culturally or beyond?
Yeah, it's funny, kind of thinking back after 9 years in the States, I start to forget what some of the differences are. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that the worst culture shock I've ever had in my life was going back home after a number of years in the US. I'd traveled a few places between kind of moving here and then going back, Papua New Guinea, the Philippines, Mexico, just kind of seen some really different places that I'd definitely not been used to growing up, and but you kind of expect the differences. Going home, I didn't expect the differences, but then all the small things just kind of totally throw you off. So you get out of the airport, and at the time it was kind of baggy jeans in the US, and everyone in London was wearing skinny jeans, and I was like, wow, this is weird. You guys look strange to me, and I wasn't expecting you to, you know. And then you try and communicate, and all of a sudden, you know, your vocabulary has changed a little bit, and communication's a difficulty. Just kind of the small things that throw you off, which really make it more of a shock to move from one culture to the other.
Wow. Yeah, I was one thing I noticed, especially in Norway didn't notice this too much in the UK, but in Norway they eat like, and not that everyone's super health nuts, but they tend to eat more whole foods there. So for breakfast, you'll have like bread and cheese and fruit. You know, you don't see people sitting around with a bag of chips in Norway or just like some massive like processed item or something like that. So and then they have coffee with everything, coffee, you know, black coffee. And then in the UK, I'm going to be honest, Ben, because I loved it, but the coffee situation is not up to par.
Not so hot? You didn't find any Starbucks?
You can't. No, there are Starbucks everywhere, but they don't, like, you can't get half and half. Like, all you, I mean, you either have to drink it black or they give you skim milk. Right. And I'm like, I am sorry, but that is not happening.
Cafe au lait. Coffee with milk. Yeah.
So, yeah. So there was this one chain there, Costa, which I guess is like the Starbucks equivalent or something for the UK. I asked them for cream and they gave me whatever, so they must have some drink that they make with heavy whipping cream because they would give me heavy whipping cream to put in my coffee, which was like the only thing I could do. Yeah. So hence I had to do a lot of hiking.
Just stir vigorously, right?
Right. Exactly. So that was pretty, pretty unique to see. But anyway, so I thought that was kind of cool. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what other cultural differences I noticed other than, you know, things being done kind of more on a small scale. You know, there's smaller shops, smaller, you don't see all this mega everything. And obviously you don't see like SUVs and weirdness. I mean, the whole public transportation system is just huge over there.
The feel is different from start to finish. I mean, apart from things being smaller, like streets and cars and doorways and, you know, everything that was built before, you know, America was populated is really small because, you know, Brits were small at that point. you know, I mean, but the horizon's smaller as well. You know, you come out to places like Colorado and you can see practically to Kansas from the top of Pike's Peak. You know, you go to England and it's rolling hills for the entire country. It's rainy 300 days a year instead of sunny 300 days a year, and so it just feels it's a little more closed in.
Yeah. I will say though that London was very it wasn't as unwieldy as I expected it to be, because for me New York can do me in, like New York City. Going there and having skyscrapers, you don't see the sun on the pavement because it's just so closed in and you don't see the horizon at all. At least London, the buildings aren't crazy tall and they're very varied. You know, you've got the very historic ones and then you've got, you know, newer ones and stuff, and it just felt like you were actually
I understand that they've made some efforts to kind of preserve the sky line and the feel of London there. So there are some parts which you probably saw them if you see Canary Wharf, they're kind of developing the business district there up, but the main kind of tourist parts of London, they've made some efforts to keep the buildings on a lower level so you can enjoy the, you know, Big Ben, which isn't really all that tall but still sticks out of the London skyline.
Exactly. And it was kind of neat too because I was able to talked to several people. In fact, a guy on my flight between Amsterdam and Norway, I was able to end up in a spiritual conversation with him. And then a guy over in Stavanger, Norway, my sister and I went into the fjords, took a cruise over there. And he owns a coffee shop, is from London and moved to Norway. Got in a conversation with him. And all of them were like, that's the one thing that we notice about Americans is you're just so friendly. Like, you just start conversations. Because I was immediately like, so, you know, are you from here? How long have you lived here? How long have you been? You know, and just starting this thing. And they're like, yeah, we probably wouldn't normally just pop into conversations with people, you know. But which I think is a good, and this is where, Matthew, I was going to ask you. I think that's a good indicator, especially for a millennial audience, of just relational, more social, more. And you've done a lot of you know, interaction through True You and through you've been on missions trips and stuff. As far as, I mean, do you think that there's an allure for that internationally, or just for, you know, for students and young adults who kind of want an international experience, whether through missions or beyond, to kind of connect in that way?
Absolutely. I think that it's just the idea of knowing somebody from some cool place is really alluring. As you say, like, I love to know that, like, I could go up to Alaska and not have to pay for a hotel room, you know, like, I could stay with people. And so I'm constantly, and, you know, not to like leverage a relationship, but I do like just knowing people in different places, and especially just learning about their life experience and kind of realizing, like, oh, you know, like America isn't necessarily the standard of how life ought to happen. And, we love where we live, but yet life happens differently in different places. And even up there in Juneau in the native village that we go to every summer, I mean, life is just significantly different in certain ways. And it's just really cool to just get to know people in different places and just kind of expand your life experience by knowing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I, you know, for all that my, for example, my family, you know, the ones that are obsessed with Norway, is like Norway can do no wrong and they're just so amazing and everything over there is so clean and whatever. And they're so, you know, they speak several languages and mm-hmm. we Americans are so stupid. And I think there's some truth to that. You know, they say if you're, you know, someone who speaks three languages is trilingual, someone who speaks two is bilingual, and someone who speaks one is American. it's kind of the way the saying goes. But all that to say, it was funny when I talked to the Norwegians and even some folks from the UK, when I'm like, so where have you been in the States? And they're like, well, I went to New York City, and then I went to Disney World. And, you know, so you kind of get the same things there, too, yeah. where their experiences are like that. But one thing I did notice, and you folks that are listening who were at the meetup in London, I was really, this was impressed upon me in talking to you, was how the church over there is very vibrant and very close-knit, probably because it has to be. There's mm-hmm. not this consumeristic mentality mm-hmm. of taking in church or big mega churches or like, you know, Willow Creeks, where you're dealing with like acres of property and multiple buildings. And one of the churches that some of the folks that I met in London go to, I was meeting in a theater and it's currently playing We Will Rock You in the theater. And so on the off days, you know, there's a huge awesome. Statue of Freddie Mercury hanging out there. And then it has a little church, you know, marquee kind of below it as well. Ben, is this kind of like, where has this been? Is this indicative of like since you've been growing up, or is this a newer thing or what?
You mean smaller churches?
Yeah, or just kind of the feel of the church in the UK. Because, sure. you know, here I was on this tour. All we do, you know, it was kind of like, oh, here we go. We're getting out of the bus to see another cathedral or another abbey or, you know, but they're empty.
Right.
And so where is the church in England today?
Right. Well, the church as you'd experience it as a tourist is very different than, you know, the flesh and blood body of Christ in England today, which you'd have to try a lot harder to find. I mean, the church was kind of an established arm of government in England for so many centuries that it's kind of woven into our historical fabric, if you will. So many of your tourist attractions and stops are going to be to cathedrals where matters of state happened and important events in history happened and all that kind of stuff. And what you're really viewing is you know, the brick and mortar history of, you know, the church in quotation marks. To a large degree, you know, that's if you kind of view it that way, that would be why you would see a kind of decline in Europe, just as governments have secularized and moved away from that kind of involvement. Even though the royal family is still technically the head of the church, all that kind of stuff. It's mm-hmm. it's very separate now. You kind of see a historical decline, but at the same time, you know, there are definitely communities that you can find where the church is life-giving and vibrant. Definitely there's a different kind of cultural approach to religion in England, though. Over here, it's kind of the default, your default answer often, at least in the parts of the country that I've lived, is I'm a Christian, you know. And then you have to kind of talk a little bit about what that really means. Mm-hmm. Whereas the default answer probably is not that in England. It might be agnostic, it might be atheist, but if someone tells you they're a Christian, then probably you can expect to find some fairly significant ways that is kind of directing their life. This is kind of personal experience that I'm talking from. It's not scientific data that I've gathered. It's the way I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because I, as I was telling you before we started taping, our tour guide was Irish and seemed to be, I felt in his comments, especially about churches or some of the historical aspects of faith in England, it seemed to almost be hostile to it. And so I was in a couple conversations with him, and near the end somehow mentioned that I host this show and kind of how I'm involved. And I actually, you know, kind of specified evangelical to him. And then he knew immediately where I stood when I said I was an evangelical. And then it was funny because then every stop where there was anything remotely, you know, Christian, had any Christian flavor, he would call out on the mic to me on the bus and say, Lisa, you know, there were some Protestants that were martyred here. You might want to make, you know, take special note of this. Or I was just like the crazy church lady. So I thought that was pretty interesting how it immediately marked me. So it was not, you know, I all of a sudden was this, this, and this based on how I identified myself.
Sure. And that hostility probably has some foundation, you know, in that the church that you were seeing on the tour is the historical church, which was interwoven with the government and through which, you know, lots of horrible crimes against humanity were perpetrated. You know, you've got Catholics in the throne for a while and they're kind of purging the country of Protestants, and then, you know, 20 years later it flip-flops and you've got the reverse going. So there's all sorts of death and intrigue to be found, which can kind of make the default position hostile towards the kind of historical church as it was interwoven with government over there.
Right. Yeah. And possibly as they look at the church in the U.S., you know, maybe there's probably some stereotypes of that as they're kind of looking across the pond, I guess.
But, sure.
It was really cool. The another thing that I thought was neat while I was there is I was trying to kind of create memories or experiences for myself. So I wasn't just trying to blaze through and look at a bunch of buildings and whatever. I did take pictures and kind of pared them down now, but there were a few things I specifically wanted to do. We did go to St. Andrews, and while we were there during the Open, which I learned you don't say the British Open because the Brits came up with it first, so it's just the Open, and then everyone else has to identify where they're from. We were there for the Open, and while we were there, Tiger Woods arrived. But my whole excitement about going to St. Andrews was I made, and I wasted our entire time there doing this, making my sister and friend take my picture running on the beach a la Eric Little, because that's where the opening credits of Chariots of Fire were filmed. Yeah. And Eric went to University of Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And so it was just kind of fun. So I just remember doing that and went to Oxford and sat in the very room, you know, at the Eagle and Child that Tolkien and Lewis did and the Inklings, and kind of, you know, read their works to one another, and just specific, you know, sitting, actually went to the Minster in York. And, you know, large cathedral there, actually attended an evensong, which we had to bust out of early. It was so embarrassing because our bus was going to leave. So we went, and then during the scripture, we just got up and left. So that was just tacky. But sorry, people of York, I did not mean for that to happen. But
they're very
just,
gracious in York.
They're very we did make it through the boys choir portion of the service. So, yeah, they're very gracious.
Guy I was Fox in a boys choir there. When I was a
you
boy.
Were?
I was.
Oh, yeah. See, that's good. But what do you guys think? And again, looking at, you know, I mean, obviously I'm a Gen Xer, but looking at millennials and kind of young adults, that whole idea of creating experience, and, you know, you, Matthew, blogged about this, about your time in Alaska and how it is a time to be set apart and away from your routine. And what would you find, or what did you find that is life altering or even not so life altering when you are able to separate and do something like that?
I guess in my experiences, and since mine has been, I mean, I don't know, people will joke that oh, you get to go on a vacation to Juneau again. and in a way, like, you know, it's not a vacation in that we really are, you know, engaging in sharing the gospel in various ways up there. But because it's not primarily a vacation, it's more of a, it's definitely a missions trip. The community that develops up there is just amazing. And it really, I think, as you know, as I blogged about, it really gives you a taste of what life could be like, and what I hope, you know, the kingdom is like, what heaven will be like. And but I think I just love getting kind of out of my element in a way that kind of makes me ask questions about, you know, normal everyday life, I guess, you know, here in Colorado. And, you know, what do I do here that maybe is a waste of time, or just like cultural differences, especially with them. I mean, that's one thing I love about going to the native villages that we go to with this 2-week trip that I go on, is the native village that we go to. I mean, they're very Americanized. I mean, you know, they the kids there know much more about pop culture than I do. And yet they still, the
but
village...
probably not more than I do, just FYI.
Probably not, yeah. I mean, they don't wear as many skulls and stuff as you do, but...
Give them time.
Exactly. But they run on a different time schedule, you know? And they say dinner's going to start at 6, and you just know that that means... anywhere from 6:30 to 8, and you just kind of show up, and everything's very relationally driven as opposed to time driven, as things are down south, as they say. Anything the lower 48 is down south to them. So, I mean, that could be Seattle, that could be Miami, Florida, but anyway, down south it's so time driven, and up there it's just so relationally driven. And I just love going to a place that kind of gets you out of your element and just makes you kind of ask questions that about life that you wouldn't ask normally. So, and I'm sure you find that even in, you know, Western Europe like you did. So.
Yeah. I thought it was neat. One of the girls at the meetup in London, we were just talking about several of them were just finishing their schooling, and they'd come from other countries and, you know, were trying to stay in London and whatever. And we were just mentioning, you know, just kind of saying our goodbyes and stuff. And just, I was trying to encourage them and what they're doing there and saying I was going to pray for them. And she was like, yeah, she said, we're just trying to make the name of Christ famous. And I just thought that was great because, you know, here I think we can get caught in just that, like you said, that cultural Christianity that kind of makes everything a little bit more milquetoast and blurs the lines between what's just our ethnicity or our cultural context of faith versus what does it mean to really have the way you live your life on the line based on who you identify with as your Lord and Savior. So I think that's cool. But, well, thanks, guys. This is good. Maybe I'll, you know, have an opportunity to share anecdotes in the future of this trip. It was great, but it is great to be back in the fray. Hello, everyone. So good to see you again. Thanks, you guys.
Pleasure. Thanks.
So dark and so deep was my life, but now I found you. And you're the source of all that's good in my life. And everyone should know what this feels like. So let it be known.
Well, hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am joined by someone who I just got to meet for the first time. His name is David Clark. He is a Christian psychologist. We love it when we can bring psychologists into our studio. So, do I have to call you Dr. Clark?
Yes, you do.
Whoa.
No, Dave's fine.
Okay. Dave is okay?
Dave's good.
Okay. Unless I have to like sign up for some of your services, then I'll be like, Dr. Clark.
Don't forget I am a doctor.
Yeah.
Not a real doctor, but close enough.
Well, it is great to have you. Welcome to the Boundless Show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Okay, well, this is going to be fun because we are going to, as I like to say, blaze people away because Dave actually has written a book, his latest book. He's written 9 books, I guess, at this point. So how you're supposedly in private practice, but how do you do that when you're writing 9 books?
I'm just a workaholic.
Okay.
I work all the time.
You write your books while people are talking to you. That's good. You just like have notes. Like
they don't even
in
notice.
File.
Exactly. Yeah. Are you texting?
Exactly. That's how it works out. Well, you're in private practice, plus you're an author, mostly in marriage, right? Marriage and marriage
relationships.
Therapy.
That's really what I see. A lot of couples, but I also see singles who are contemplating relationship or having broken up or having issues. So
okay. Yeah. That would be us. That would be our audience.
Okay,
so
well,
that's
perfect
awesome.
Then.
We have a lot of people that just get into relationships and, you know, break up. So, wow, sorry about that, folks. But we've heard from you, so that's the case. But anyway, well, this is cool because this is an opportunity. Dave has written a book, and again, Dr. David Clark, and that's Clark with an E, C-L-A-R-K-E. Your latest book is called Kiss Me Like You Mean It. And I'm sure you're just like, oh, my word, here I'm going to talk to this Boundless audience, because this is largely, the subtitle is Solomon's Crazy in Love How-To Manual. So primarily for married couples who we would say, you know, go into marriage, are all gangbusters, and then feel like they've lost the spark, and they're like, whoa, what do I do? And you're like, well, you know what? Let's read the Bible.
Right. That's kind of my focus here. Get back to the Bible.
Right.
So what am I doing here?
Exactly. Okay, so here we are talking to our Boundless audience, which largely is young adults, mostly single. And so we're going to say, you know, well, what in the world would this book have to do with us? But I was flipping through it, and I have a couple questions for you. And specifically, I mean, not necessarily saying you have to give this massive outline of the book or whatever, but I think it's fascinating that you used Song of Solomon really to drive a lot of the content of this book and say, well, let's look how it was done here. And how did, you know, Solomon deal with this relationship, obviously. And obviously, it must have worked out well in the end because it ended up in Scripture.
Right. It is solid. God wants it in there.
It is solid. Okay, so my first question for you, Dave, is should singles even read the book of Song of Solomon?
I think so. More money for me.
Okay.
I mean, come on.
Not your book. Should they read the biblical book?
Oh, sorry.
So we'll read your book, of course.
I definitely think so, because part of their relationship was a courtship relationship. They were not married in the initial part of the book. So there's a lot of issues you can learn from there to marry the right person and be ready. But then even the principles in their relationship, it was the first few years of their marriage that the book covers, the song covers. So yeah, you can get a lot of clues in terms of how to really make your marriage work well.
Okay. So why do you think people don't read that book too often, though? Because it's certainly, I mean, I was actually telling a few people around the office that I was going to do this interview, and they're like, wow, you know, that's really awkward. That's really, you know, like we just can't talk about it or something. I mean, what do you think has kind of spurred on this fear of that book within Scripture?
You know, people have the heebie-jeebies. Anything regarding sex, you know, we just kind of, maybe that's kind of nasty or naughty, or we don't talk about that in the church or in Christian circles, which is crazy. God invented it. He wants us to enjoy it in the context of marriage, but many churches simply don't. And many parents are very awkward with it, so you don't hear about it. A brief talk about the birds and the bees, if they even do that, it's about all you get. You learn from your friends. So there's this kind of hovering sense of, this is kind of creepy and kind of weird. Not smart, because the more you know about sex before you get married, the better off you're going to be. And not just sex, but all kinds of relationship principles. Plus, when you read the song, that's why my book can be a helpful guide, because it's hard to understand. Metaphorical language, analogies used, you know, 3,000-year-old, you know, allusions to sex are kind of hard to pick up. So, but the principles are there. So if you have a guide that you can read along with, well, then it comes alive. And the principles are terrific.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of sex, even in a married context, do you think that a lot of people go into marriage with an unrealistic expectation of sex that's driven whether from our culture or from, you know, stories they hear or whatever? And that, because I think generally most people's story or what the way that they tell it is, you know, yeah, we went into marriage, you know, and then the sex was great for like the first year or whatever. And then we had kids and then it just peters out. And then it's just that's reality.
Very common story. You know what? You get 1 year of good
sex.
Is there
hope for anyone? And what is the hope for people?
No, there's not. Just kidding.
No.
No, that happened to my wife and I, Sandy. We were having great sex. And of course, in the first year or two of our marriage, in fact, the first 3 years. And then we had Emily. So it's like, whoa. And that when we
You made it three,
we
recovered. Though. That's good. That's
we did. Nobody can take that three away from
okay.
us.
Okay. There you go.
Then we had three kids right in a row. And so we had to start working around them. So it's a matter of carving out the time. But the expectations, yeah, I thought it would be great. I thought it'd always be great. I was in love with her. She's absolutely gorgeous. She still is. And we have the hots for each other, which is great. But that's only the lead. That's very superficial, the leading edge of what you need to understand. Nobody taught me how to meet the sexual needs of a woman. I didn't have a clue. In fact, I was more into meeting my own needs, to tell you the truth. And so my orgasm became the big thing. Well, that's not what it's about. So we made the mistake of learning how to do sex a certain way, and then we kept doing it that way. Well, you got to branch out. You got to be out of the box. And the book of Song of Songs can help you with that. A lot of creativity going on there. So, and Sandy had expectations too, and she, I think she thought that I would really be the greatest lover in the history of the world. I was close. But, it wasn't even close, actually. So we have to start working together like everything else.
Okay.
And it's such an important area. I mean, men alive, God wants us to enjoy it.
Yeah. So what are some of the biggest myths that people have going into marriage, whether just specifically sexually in marriage or like you said, I mean, you each probably had a somewhat skewed picture of the other person and your needs and your expectations. So what are those things that generally breed those differences?
Now, one big one is, you know, it's just always going to be great. You know, we because when you're dating and courting, and you shouldn't be having sex, but if you're involved physically, kissing, making out, it is fantastic. The energy's there. I mean, what could go wrong? We just have it. and we don't even have to talk first. You know, we just have the hots for each other. Well, that's not true. That's a lie. After you get married, then the emotional intimacy becomes vitally important, and spiritual intimacy bonding before you can hit the bedroom. Now, you're always preparing for sex. When you're dating and single, no, there's no preparation of any kind. We were the same way. We didn't have to. We were just there. We had to fight not having sex because we were so attracted to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's a big whopper of a lie and of something that's a myth. Also, that it's just going to be easy. It's just the world even says it's going to be natural, mm-hmm. and you're not really going to have to work at it too hard, because if you're really truly in love, it should just flow. Mm-hmm. And when you see sex on the screen and TV or a movie, it's always effortless, and mm-hmm. there's really no problem. People don't say, "Hey, you're hurting me," or mm-hmm. "You grab my hair." I can't stand when you do that. It's always just beautiful. Well, you know what? That's not real life. Mm-hmm. Real life is your knees in my groin. Mm-hmm. I had to tell you that, and it's kind of throwing me off here. So we have to work as a team. Mm-hmm. So those are those myths. Another myth, which is really nasty, is that, and the world pushes this on us, is that one partner is never going to be enough. The world's not really too concerned. Satan isn't. When I say the world, it's really Satan in the world, about the longevity of your marriage. Who cares? Mm-hmm. You're going to have great sex for a while. You're going to be infatuated, and then you're going to lose it. Everybody does. Mm-hmm. And then just find somebody else. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have, now the truth there is you're going to have another burst of infatuation and great sex, but it will never be a deep, committed relationship. Mm-hmm. When you've been with someone 27 years like Sandy and I have been, and you've worked at the areas of your marriage, especially sex, it is so much better than it could ever be early on, because you know each other, and it's about the relationship and communication and how can I meet your needs. So those are some of the key myths that people just get pushed on them.
Okay. So obviously, as singles, you know, especially those who are now young adults, 20s, you know, 30s, anticipating marriage, and many of our audience is and is trying to prepare for marriage. What do we do in the meantime, though? I guess my question is, how do singles, in light of Scripture, in light of who we're created to be, live as sexual beings while living lives of, you know, living chaste lives while anticipating marriage?
Yeah, boy, that is a real toughie. Sandy and I went through that experience, and every young person does. You've got all these hormones, and you are attracted to a member of the opposite sex. And let's say it's even a good relationship. Well, the next natural thing is to have sex with them, and that God made us that way. But we know, according to the Bible, that will actually mess up the relationship and cause all kinds of problems. It short circuits the development of the emotional and the spiritual. So you have to create clear boundaries. You have to agree that we're not going to be in certain situations, and we're going to go, here's how far we're going to go in our relationship sexually. Certainly kissing's all right, making out is all right, but we have to decide how far we're going to go. Intercourse is off the table, but you've got to push it back from there, because obviously if you're going to do everything but that, you're not going to hold out for long. That's mm-hmm. the next step. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're involved here, and it's been fantastic. It's been a couple of months, and now we keep coming up to the edge of intercourse, but we're not going there. Baloney. You're mm-hmm. going to go there. Mm-hmm. So you have to back it up to a point you both agree on. I put the man in charge. That's what the Bible says, even though you're not married yet. Male leadership is key, but you have to have buy-in from both. Someone's got to be the one to say, this far and no farther. Mm-hmm. Plus, I think the real key is to develop the emotional and spiritual parts of the relationship. That's protective of you. That's what you're really doing to see if you're going to be married for 40, 50 years to the right person. Because anyone can be compatible physically. Okay, so we have chemistry. That is not what's going to make a great marriage. Can we talk? Can we resolve conflict? Can we share Christ in the right way? Do we have a spiritual life together? So if you really work on those areas, well, you're going to be in much better shape.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that, because we've often described here on the Boundless Show, and I think this is someone else's analogy, but we've pulled it, that idea of, you know, the on-ramp to the freeway. I mean, that there's a reason why there's an on-ramp, and you're not supposed to stop on the on-ramp and back up. You're supposed to eventually get on the freeway, and you just move in one direction to get there. And that's why I think, you know, we're saying that, you know, those boundaries have to be set up, and they have to be set up far enough back that you're not, you know, pretty much heading for the freeway at that point. So give us then, because your book especially takes apart the Song of Solomon, give us a practical application. I don't think I've ever heard a practical application then of the verse, "Do not awaken love until it so desires." that one from Proverbs. I mean, is that what we're talking about here? Just boundaries or what? I mean, really, what? Because we could have people here who are now in their 30s and they're like, I would like this to awaken at some point. And it is not. So exactly. How can I live with any kind of hope in the midst of this verse telling me, you know, just wait, you know, indefinitely?
Well, one practical truth, and people know this, it is one hellacious battle. It is. You know what? God expects that. He's made us that way. So there's something to the fact that he knows we're going to have this terrible struggle. Couldn't he have changed that? He didn't do that. Mm. If you're really attracted and even it's the right person, how in the world can you not awaken that physical love to the nth degree all the way to intercourse before you're married? It's absolutely very difficult. Well, what you're going to have to do is, it's really a faith issue, I think, more than anything else, Lisa. You will really make it an issue of before God. I think he wants us to come to him, make it a matter of prayer, pray together as a couple about it specifically, so that he becomes the one that will help you not do it. In fact, he's the only one that can. If it was just Sandy and I, we would have had intercourse a number of times before marriage. Not the end of the world. You can still recover from that. But it's against God's plan A, and it causes all kinds of problems. You don't need that kind of grief. So we try to make it a matter of faith and to pray before him and to seek his help and guidance. And then, of course, we would structure our dates so that we would not end up in the wrong place. Maybe we would have the physical part of our time together early on in the date, you know, bright outside, in a public place or somewhere where it would be a little safer. Because if you leave it off until the end, well, then everything's building and then you might have a problem. We'd avoid certain areas and we would consciously say, look, we're going to have a conversation tonight. That's what this date's really about. It's not about you and I physically. And so just trying to segment and come up with strategies, every couple's a little different. Those are things that helped us. And really, when you felt yourself, both of us had to be honest, if you are starting to lose it and it's a weak day or, gosh, I really want to be close to you and I want more, and the woman can often push for it, not just the guy, obviously, you've got to be aware of that, and someone's got to raise a hand and say, okay, we're going too far. Let's take a moment. Let's literally walk around the car if you're in the car or the restaurant or one of your apartments. You have to just, you know, and bring it to God right then and there. You just have to do that. And then that may be the end of the date. But you have to really be hard about it. In the end, it pays off. Mm-hmm. But it's tough. It's never easy for anybody. If it's easy, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
I tell couples, if you don't have the hots for each other, don't get married. Mm-hmm. There should be a lot of chemistry there. And so if you don't have it and this is easy for you, you're with the wrong person. Mm-hmm. It should be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, where does emotional intimacy play into this? Because I know a lot of friends who, especially now in our culture of meeting online, where maybe you're having a long distance relationship, I know many women, especially, who give up too much in a relationship on the front end emotionally and or are willing to talk about sex and all of that, like maybe a little bit too extensively, getting, you know, because that breeds temptation too, I think, when you're basically like on the phone, you know, and even engaged couples, you know, I mean, I had a friend who said, you know, we were counseled against talking about sex too much, even as an engaged couple, because all it would do was, you know, it just breeds temptation. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think one of the keys is to understand that, you know, you've got to ask the tough questions right up front. A lot of women give away way too much. You're right, and it's easy: texting, email, phone. It's a pseudo kind of relationship. It's superficial. And you can really begin to share things you would never share in person. So you got to be careful. Mm-hmm. But you always ask the key questions. Who the person is that you're dating is more important than anything else. Their picture, their background, you ask them, and the first question is, do you know Jesus Christ? And you make them believe, make you believe that they have made that commitment, because guys that want to get into girls' pants will say anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always have from time immemorial. What do I have to say to really get somewhere with
Remember
Susie?
Remember that, ladies. Remember that.
Oh.
Okay.
And they can be very charming, a lot of con men. I mean, they know that the guys practice their lines in front of the mirror, and they mm-hmm. practice on other chicks, mm-hmm. and they hone their skills. So, you want the real McCoy.
Okay.
Do you know Jesus? When did you come to Jesus? We want just a Christian. We want not the next Billy Graham, but somebody who's really living for the Lord. Mm-hmm. And you tell me, before we even go anywhere else, you tell me and I'll tell you what I'm doing spiritually. See, that's the kind of guy, if I'm talking to the ladies, who is going to be the kind of guy who will hold the line physically, who will mm-hmm. be the great husband you want him to be. Not a guy that will just score with you and then dump you in the trash and move on. There's mm-hmm. there's more many more guys like that. Mm-hmm. The ladies know I'm talking to. Oh, they're everywhere. They're thick as flies. Mm-hmm. Dirt balls, every single one of them. Now, they come they come, they don't have dirt ball written over their chest or on their mm-hmm. forehead. They look pretty good, and they'll talk the talk. Hey, I'd like to go to church with you. Well, you know what? If you haven't been going to church when I met you, I'm not going to go out with you. Mm-hmm. Give me 6 months of some church here and make it real, and I'm holding you back. So, you know, would you hold yourself back, even emotionally? Because you're right, Liz. If you give yourself emotionally, it's only a matter of time before you're going to give yourself physically. Mm-hmm. So you're careful.
Mm-hmm. Jesus. And you start writing things off, like things that are definite red flags. All of a sudden, they just become orange flags, and then they're yellow flags.
Exactly. Yeah, and then you start rationalizing.
The guy's a freak, but he's somehow just the Lord has, you know, I'm sure the Lord will take a hold of him, and, you know, well, yeah.
Yeah, later on. Mm-hmm. You know what? No. And you might even get married to the guy, and then all of a sudden, he's not that great a Christian. You know what? Bad. So find that out up front. You're not looking for perfection, but somebody who's a real person. Here are my struggles with the Lord. Here's my spiritual path. What is your commitment, Bob? If your name is Bob, what is your commitment to, what is your feeling about sex before marriage? And we'll see what he says. And then you ask him about previous relationships. You want to know. Mm-hmm. Well, I've had sex with the last 10 girls I dated, but you're going to be different. Don't kid me, Bob. You're a dirtball. And I'm not dating you again. So those are questions that can be asked. Because some of these eHarmony things and the dating things, they can work. I've had clients, but only if you're very careful about it. You don't open up too soon. That's a precious thing when I start talking about me. So find out who the person is, where they come from, their relationship history. You got to know.
Okay. The other thing that I really like that you talk about in your book, which I think is fantastic, and again, the book is Kiss Me Like You Mean It, is that you go through different scenarios of conflict, different types of people as to how they deal with conflict, everything from the person who crawls into their shell to the person who just blazes someone away with screaming to the person who wants to avoid conflict altogether. Obviously, we all know people like this, not ourselves, because we ourselves deal perfectly with conflict and we're communicators. We just want to communicate, you know, but everyone else has a problem. And so what's your advice to couples in relationships, whether marriage or dating couples, engaged couples, as far as like, you know, deal breakers in dealing with conflict, and how really do they work through that with different styles?
Good question. This is an absolute key. And the song has some clues for us. You want to have 10 to 15 serious fights with anybody before you even get to the point where you're going to think about marrying them. Critically, most folks don't do just the opposite.
Wow.
You know, if we get along so well, we shouldn't be fighting. Baloney. Date someone long enough where you're going to have something go wrong. Because when you get married, the roof's going to cave in on you. All the differences, all the stuff that happens. So if you have a relationship where you can stay in love and yet handle your conflict, now that's strong. That's something that can last. If your first conflict, you're blown away and you break up, of course, that isn't the right person. So you want to know how to, you talk about your conflict styles and how you handle conflict, and you want a person who will work with you to resolve conflict in a healthy way before you marry him. Look, nobody does that. If one person listening to this does it, they'll be better off. When I do premarital, I will be very clear with couples. You need to, we never have fights. We're perfect. You know, you're making me gag. Where's my trash can? I'm going to throw up. You're not going to live the whole lifetime this way. They think they will. Baloney. So let's start practicing conflict, and let's date someone long enough so conflict occurs. Doesn't mean it's the wrong person. It means it may be the right person, but depending on how they handle it. And if that person's a stuffer, let's say you're dating a guy that's a stuffer, that has to change before you become engaged and marry him. He struggles with it. He always will, but he will actually engage with you and talk through in stages an issue and not just ignore it or act like it never happened like a lot of guys do. We have a fight today and the guy just ignores it. And then the next day drives women crazy. She tosses and turns all night. We haven't resolved this. There's no closure. And the guy the next day acts like nothing happened. You know, it's like the Twilight Zone. That's not right. You know what, buddy? Yeah. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about every issue that comes up in our relationship because that's what relationships are. So you find out about what they're like in conflict, admit your own issues there, and start learning how to resolve conflict. You're going to be so much better off.
Okay.
Because you have conflict the rest of your married life.
Yeah. Okay. Well, especially if you're someone like me who tends to just kind of put it out there. So I could date someone for like, you know, 2 days and be in conflict with them. So I'll get to marriage pretty quickly. And I wanted to get back to that point because you said, you know, date someone long enough so that you can be in conflict with them. Obviously. So how do we find this balance? Because here at The Boundless Show, we tell people, you know, do not protract your singleness to the point where you're, you know, 35 and you feel you have to date someone for 7 or 8 years to get this thing on the table. You know, I mean, so obviously you're just thinking of like a healthy time period where you can talk about real stuff and obviously get into the person's life, get to know them. And we always say it's helpful to have other people in both of your lives as well. Good mentors, good right. you know, people who can observe that person
exactly.
objectively, because
right.
you tend to lose some objectivity, I think, when you have that first, you know, whoa, they're so amazing.
Yeah. And so. I'm talking 4 to 5, 6 months. It's not mm-hmm. not years.
Okay.
Because when you're older as a single, you know, you should have matured. The person you're dating should be mature enough where you can, yeah, you're real people, and it should happen a lot quicker than that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just pie in the sky and gaga over somebody, well, you know what? That for a year, okay, something's wrong,
mm-hmm.
and something's not real. So I think within 4 to 6 months, you can pretty much know, is this a real candidate or
mm-hmm.
not? I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's your feedback on the book been so far, especially from married couples? Because I think a lot of us on this side of marriage... you know, we either, and we've talked about this a little bit here, we either think, well, you know, that's not going to be my issue. That's not going to be my problem because I'm amazing and I'm only going to marry someone amazing. And so we won't have any trouble. Or we're so paralyzed by being children of divorce or of just broken families or whatever that we're just like, there's no way I'm ever going to have a good story. So how are people really applying the messages that you have in this book?
You know, what I've heard so far and from couples of all ages, and even some singles, is that they were amazed that the Song of Solomon has this much to say mm-hmm. about marriage. They think it was just about sex. No,
mm-hmm.
it's not. It's about much, 3/4 of it is not about sex at all. It's about
mm-hmm.
building a relationship. So they're kind of blown away by, whoa, what a great guide to really, you know, build a great relationship. And they're surprised by all the different passion principles that it covers. And it's a lot of fun to read. People are enjoying it. I think the song itself is a fun book to read. It's filled with kind of humor and a lot of back and forth, a lot of positives.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been kind of surprised that it's been as much fun to read and that it's so practical.
Mm-hmm.
It's God is very specific in the book, in the song, on just do this, don't do that, do this, and it works. So
mm-hmm.
I'm getting some great feedback.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you think, I'm just trying to picture in my mind, like, single people sitting around reading this and discussing this, you know?
Yeah, me too.
It's one. maybe we'll have to do like a focus group and have, you know, Dr. David Clark leads a singles discussion in the Song of Solomon. I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of like, it's just funny to me. I mean, it literally has been like the taboo book in any kind of circle I've been in. It's like, you know,
yeah.
let's read through, you know, Numbers again. Let's do that. Just let's not touch Song of Solomon. So it's just, that's awesome.
Well,
so.
I hope they do, because I was not that well prepared for marriage. I had a great home, but still, I didn't have a clue. And we get married, we had to learn a lot on our own. So if I'd been better prepared, I think it's great preparation. And even the sexual passages, if you know what you're doing prior to marriage, well, you're just better off.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little dicey. That's why your faith has to be strong, and you have to really have a Christian partner you're working with, someone strong, because it's very titillating. And it's like, whoa, it makes me really want to have sex, reading about sexual passages. Well, but they were married when they did that. But if you can hold the line, it's great preparation. So I think singles need to buy this book.
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to buy my boat? Unless people, singles, buy this book.
Well, we do want to help you toward that goal.
Please.
That is for
that's
sure.
why I'm
that's,
here. Lisa.
That's what we do. That's what we do here at
and
the
And to help
show.
People, of course. But
Well, good. Well, awesome. Well, I definitely would encourage people. And certainly, you know, we have plenty of married couples that listen to the show as well and tell your friends about it as well. But I think it is a good book for all of us to check out. It's called Kiss Me Like You Mean It, Solomon's Crazy in Love How-To Manual by Dr. David Clark. And just kind of as we finish up here, Dr. Clark, I want to ask you, because we were talking about marriage and preparation for marriage. So, like, sex aside, what, from your years of practice, would you say, I mean, you know that you're going to go into marriage, you know that you have to look for a believer. What are the other just 2 or 3 things that you think are absolutely pivotal to entering into marriage in a healthy way, knowing that you have these things cleared on the table about the person that you're considering?
I would say someone who is willing to work on their own issues. Look, we all have them.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you get to know someone, you find out, well, their weaknesses and difficult background, and maybe mom and dad were divorced. That isn't a deal breaker, obviously, but have they worked on their issues? Are they willing to address things? Vitally important, because
mm-hmm.
that's going to come up
Do
in your marriage.
Do they recognize their issues?
Right. Exactly. That would be, yeah,
would be
I'll
good.
See you later if they're not even
mm-hmm.
going to go there. Oh, my family was perfect. You know,
mm-hmm.
don't waste my time.
Mm-hmm.
Communication is vital. You have to have someone who can communicate with you. And even when times get tough, we mentioned the conflict, someone that's going to work through every conflict with you, every single one. Not just 3/4, because the other 1/4 will kill you. But we have a conversation. A marriage is really an ongoing series of conversations. And you really get along and you can reach a deeper level with that person. Not some fake level, but they're open, they reveal. A lot of guys will talk in the courtship phase to a degree, but not when they get married. You've got to be sure he's going to talk through things. And really the best way to do that is to have a guy, when things are awkward, we have something tough to talk about, honey, we need to talk. Every man hates to hear that, but someone's got to say it. They will actually do it. Now, that's a guy who's probably much more prone to be open with you and share. And you want a guy who's ironclad and you believe him. When we get married, that's it. We are going to stay married. I don't care what happens. You also want a person who is not, you know, drawn to the opposite sex. This is obviously a huge red flag, but I see it all the time. If you're out with a guy, and let's say you're the woman, and he's checking out every woman in the room, look, get up, make him pay for the dinner, and leave. That's not the guy you want. He should be enthralled with you. You notice people, but I'm talking about something that's obvious. I mean, please. You also want someone who's at least basically emotionally stable. There are some nutballs out there. How can I tell you? I'm a shrink. But, you know, crazy people, people that really have issues. And if you have a tendency, if you had a difficult home, you may be drawn to saving people. You do not want to save your marriage partner because you never will be able to do it. Because what brought you together is that you're screwed up and I'm trying to help you. Well, that will stay on forever. If the books actually got better, you probably dump them. So you want somebody who has issues but isn't a nutball, isn't a real, you know, screwed up mess and won't work on their issues. And sometimes they can fool you. Or the actual fact that they're messed up draws you. If you've got that issue, man, you better get that fixed or you're going to get a project and you don't want a project.
Yeah. I know that's another big red flag that I have with some of my girlfriends that I've seen where... you know, there it's like the dark, mysterious guy. And she's like, I'm going to draw him out of a shell. I will certainly be able to communicate with him. I will whatever. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe he's dark and mysterious because he's a drug addict or he is a freak or he is whatever.
Chances are very high.
But they get kind of this again from the movies, kind of that brooding, you know, whether it's a Mr. Darcy persona or whether it's a James Dean persona.
Now he's a vampire. If he's a vampire, that's a great relationship. I think I'm going to be with him. Oh, please.
Well, at least if he's a vampire, he's put it on the table and you pretty know what you're pretty much know what you're doing.
Honey,
right?
I'm a vampire. Yeah, Mr. Dark and Mysterious.
As long as he's honest about it.
Bad idea.
Yeah.
But it's the bad boy. And you're right. In the media, that's always the guy. It's not the steady guy who's an engineer, you know, with horn-rimmed glasses. Oh, forget that loser. You know what? He's probably a better choice.
Oh, engineers, listen to that. You guys, be encouraged. He just gave a shout-out to you. That's good. So, well, honestly, this has been awesome. We've been talking with Dr. David Clark. He is the author of Kiss Me Like You Mean It. That's his latest book. He also has a bunch of other books as well. Where can folks find out more about you, Dave?
The website. Okay. All about Dave Clark, all the books I've written, things I'm into. DavidClarkSeminars.com. Clark with an E. Don't forget my E. DavidClarkSeminars.com.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we'll make sure we direct people there and they can get the scoop. And obviously, if they're in Tampa, you know, they're just going to, you're going to need to take them on as a client.
No question. Yes. Who else would they want to go to? Come on.
He will chat with you and just say, you know, the Boundless Show sent me. And
I might give him a discount.
Then he'll
actually, I won't.
Then he'll realize, oh, my word, you know, yeah, you do need some help then because I met Lisa. And quite frankly, let's be honest. So, well, this has been fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lisa.
Everyone, we are opening up this week's inbox, and I have Glenn Stanton with me. Glenn, thanks for hanging around.
It's good to be with you, Lisa.
Well, you are, I mean, only in part because it's part of your job title, but in part because I tend to give you this title as well. You're kind of our men expert focus. You've done a lot on fatherhood and the importance of fathers. Mm-hmm. You've done a lot on the family dynamic, even the Christian family. In fact, throw out a couple of your book titles because I didn't do
that. My Marriage Matters, my first one, which talks about what marriage does, why it matters for us as people. And then another book, My Crazy Imperfect Christian Family, which is really this idea that whoever came up with this idea of the perfect Christian family, it does not exist. And that's not sadness. God creates it that way so that the roughness, the difficulty of family shapes us into the people that he wants us to be. Marriage on Trial is another book which addresses the issue of same-sex marriage and parenting. And then the book that I'm working on now is Secure Daughters, Confident Sons, How Mothers and Fathers Contribute to Raising Healthy Masculine and Feminine Men and Women.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anticipating that book kind of drives into our question today. And so I want to, I'm actually just going to paraphrase it because it's from a guy, obviously. So we're talking about guys. It's all guys all the time this time around. But I want to basically address it in this way. Basically, he's saying, you've been quoted, Glenn, as saying that men are not born, they're actually built. Mm-hmm. So there's the making of men. It's actually a process.
You've got to be intentional.
Right. So this guy is saying, you know, here I am, didn't grow up in a Christian home, didn't grow up with a dad. I'm now sitting in my early 30s trying to turn the tide. I want to get married. I want to have a family. I want to be a godly man and godly leader in the workplace, in my church, in a family eventually. Did I miss the boat? What is there for me? I was not built in the construct that you're probably talking about.
Yeah.
So where do I go from here and what hope is there?
Well, the good news is that two pieces of good news. One, the door doesn't slam shut at a particular period. You know, after that, too late. Mm. The other piece of good news is that if men were honest about themselves, that is where most men are. You know, it's really the rare man who says, you know what, my dad just did a rockin' good job of making me into the man that I am today. All of us have insecurities. All of us have weaknesses. So I would say to this guy at, you know, mid-30s, it's not too late. Yes, there are things that you have to deal with. There's things that you are struggling with clearly, but that puts you in line with most other guys out there. The thing that you can do now is recognize and realize what masculinity really looks like. And I would say very clearly, masculinity is not, you know, getting bike racks on your car and being this outdoors guy and things like that. You really have to ask yourself the question that this thing called masculinity that I'm after, if it really is true, then it has to be true for people in my community, in my neighborhood. But also, what about the Chinese man who works in the rice fields, you know, a world away, or in India or South Africa? You know, there is universal masculinity. And so we do have to ask ourselves that question. I think a lot of it comes down to, one, confidence, just a confidence in who you are and who your identity is. I mean, I would say that I'm 48 years old. I still struggle with that from my family of origin. And I am working on seeing myself as God sees me. I mean, we would think that in our Christian walk, I've been walking with Christ for 30 years, that we would get it down by now. But you know what? It is a daily struggle. So let us not think that, oh my goodness, you know, age 22 is gone and passed and, you know, now the door's shut. No, that's not the thing. It's understanding who you are as a man and how God has shaped you with a man and what does he want you to be?
Okay. So what are a few other, you kind of touched on the confidence thing.
Yeah.
What are a few other things that guys should look at internally and externally that would be biblically driven for really understanding, okay, here's where I need to grow as a man. Mm-hmm. Here's where I'm doing pretty well. Here's where I maybe need to pull someone in alongside me to help me.
I would say confidence is the big thing. We talked about that. The next one is really servanthood.
Not to be confused with bravado.
Right. You know what? Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. Because we think about this, and in this book that I'm working on now, I've thought about who are men that emulate this kind of masculinity. And you know what? I didn't go with Mel Gibson and these big old macho guys. It's more, who are the men that serve well? Mm-hmm. Who are the men that are interested in other people? That's what young men ought to look for. When another man that I'm seeking to emulate is in a room, Is he interested in listening to the other people, hearing the other people, or is it all about him talking about himself? That's not masculinity. I mean, that's arrogant boyhood. You know, it's a good man. We think about thinking of marriage. You know, Paul tells us that husbands should be as their wives. Husbands should be to their wives as Christ is to the church. Christ was all about laying down his life, giving up his life. You know, I'm reading this biography of this great leader in the last century, and one of the things that they said about him was, for all of his brilliance and everything, he listened to people with intensity. Hmm. You know, I think that's masculine, mm-hmm. to be that confident in yourself and being able to hear other people. Another is being willing to take chances, calculated chances. You know, you think about Lewis and Clark. You know, those guys, we don't think of them as, you know, these big macho burly guys. You know what? They took a huge chance. They were bright. They were brilliant. But they took off on this trip not knowing what was going to happen. They didn't have an end game plan, but they did it. Christopher Columbus, people. I mean, you look at the great men from history, and women too, but largely men, they took chances. They could have failed miserably, but they took these chances that were calculated. They weren't foolish chances, but they were willing to take it. They were willing to take the chance and do that. And I think that's another thing that men have to be willing to do.
Yeah, that's huge. And I think, you know, kind of the idea too of, like we were saying, you know, okay, the difference between confidence and bravado.
Yeah.
That understanding, that willingness to, like you said, to be quiet and to mm-hmm. learn, to be yes. teachable, to be humble. It's not about going out and proving yourself. I know a lot of guys mm-hmm. say, well, girls just want the bad boys. That's all they want is the bad yeah. boys. And I don't really know of any girl in right. my acquaintance that, right. now maybe that plays out in certain ways because maybe they see the confidence and maybe guys are seeing that as bad boys, but.
Well, exactly.
You know, guys who are quiet and confident and secure
girls
in who they are.
Girls want a guy they can depend on. Mm-hmm. You know, and they don't even necessarily want a guy who's going to be hitting home runs all the time, mm-hmm. you know, grand slams all the time in terms of just life, career. They will be wonderful with the quiet guy who has a confidence about himself, who knows what he wants to do in life and is able to do it. Mm-hmm. And it is that confidence. That confidence is deeply attractive to women. I mean, you said it so right. It's not bravado. Bravado mm-hmm. is paper thin. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's masking mm-hmm. insecurity. And women have a keen sense to be able to discern that yeah. and see that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that if you ask most girls within groups, you know, who is it the guys that you really could see yourself settling down with, it's going to be oftentimes the more quieter, confident guys mm-hmm. Who just seem like they have it together, mm-hmm. you know?
Not only have it together, but I know this is often used for women, too, as a point of advice. You know, women are always told, guys really are attracted to a woman who kind of knows what she's doing with her life, who's mm-hmm. out there, who's involved in her church, in her community, who kind mm-hmm. of has a life, who isn't sitting at home every night, yeah. you know, with a yeah. movie and a box of tissues. Mm-hmm. I think that's true for men as well. Like when a woman sees a guy who's like, you know what, I'm interested in marriage, I'm going to pursue marriage, I'm on that path, but in the meantime, I'm a member of my church, I'm mm-hmm. serving my church, I'm moving up in my career, yep. I'm not sitting around waiting for someone to direct me or mm-hmm. tell me, that's a good evidence, I think, of that confidence.
But on the other hand, is not like this super ambitious guy mm-hmm. that is this really thin veneer covering the insecurity. No, he's just out there living life.
Right.
He's involved, he's jumping into the deep end, and he's doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the helpful things is, like, for this guy who writes in, is to think about who are men in your life that really do emulate the kind of masculinity that you want to follow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a big political fan, and I'm you know, I don't want to bring this up, but you think about, like, Ronald Reagan, okay? Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan was not this super macho swagger guy, but he had this wonderful confidence about him, mm-hmm. you know? And he didn't push his weight around at home with Nancy, you know?
Yeah.
And there are men like this out there. I think about in the Christian realm. I'm a big fan of Tim Keller. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of over and against the real superstar kind of people who put out big books that are, you know, flashy. You know what? Tim Keller, you don't think of him as a guy's guy. But you know what? He has that confidence, that security about him. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the kind of guys that I would say, men, if you want to look for an example, that's the kind of guy that you want to follow. That's the kind of guy that you want to be about. Billy Graham's another wonderful example there, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I think we need to emulate men and find men like that within our communities that we can say, you know what, help me be the kind of man that you are.
Yeah. And I think that's huge, too. Going, you know, young men out there who are listening need to realize that maybe this will be a point of action on their part. Mm-hmm. If they see a guy in their church, they need to go up to him and say, you know what?
Yeah.
There are elements of you, there are points in your character that I've seen that I would like to emulate. Would you be able to meet with me once a week for breakfast so mm-hmm. I can just learn about you so you can, and then not only are you learning and learning from this guy, but these guys are going to help you as you find yeah. someone that you want to pursue. They're going to yeah. help you find potential women of good character in their mm-hmm. sphere. You know, I mean, it just makes sense.
And that's, yeah, there's a number of those things. And again, don't look for the superstar guys, mm-hmm. you know, the leader of the elder board and things like that. Look for the guy who works at, you know, the hardware store, but he's worked there for 20 years. He knows what he's doing or owns his own business. And then look at how he deals with his wife and his children. Mm-hmm. That's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, is that the kind of guy that I want to be in 20 or 30 years? Find that guy. And if he even says, you know what, I really don't do that. I mean, what do I have to teach you? Actually, that is a very good sign mm-hmm. because he doesn't see himself as, you know, he's just living it. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of guy that you want to go after and say, you know what, I just want to learn from you. Mm-hmm. And those guys really are around, and they'll actually be honored, I think, if young men come up to them and ask them.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, too, that the guy who is doing that, who is finding this guy and is meeting with him, is the guy that the women are going to take notice of.
Absolutely.
Because
Absolutely.
They're not going to take notice of the guy who's sitting around telling the women, how come you didn't email me about bowling? I wanted to go bowling with you. No, go up and do it.
Right.
Find these
exactly.
guys.
That's
Don't sit
exactly
around waiting
right.
for the women to direct your social calendars. Yeah. Go out and get it done, and the women yeah. will take notice.
So. And that man will say, dude, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Be the man. Step mm-hmm. up here. And help you do that in the right way. And that goes back to the primary point is, I think if you leave women to their own, they more easily and naturally become women. Men do not do that. That's not just a Christian ideal. That is a human ideal. I mean, the anthropologists teach us that every culture in New York City and Manhattan and the most primitive tribe, you know, somewhere else in the world, every older man has to take the younger men and teach them how to be men. It's not that we in our time are somehow different. Every human culture is that way. Our problem is we're thinking that the next generation of good, healthy men will just come along like the 515 train, and it's not the case. Yeah. We have to be intentional about creating them.
Yeah. All right. Well, awesome. Glenn Stanton, everyone. Thanks so much, Glenn, for
Thanks, Lisa.
Addressing this week's question. That is it for this week's show. As always, please write to us, editor@boundless.org. These questions come from you, and we need to hear from you if we're going to go ahead and answer them. So stay tuned. We'll hopefully be in touch with you sometime soon. You'll find us around and about, and it's always fun when I can bring new voices in to the show,
yeah.
and just great to have you and others weigh in as well. So that is it for this week's show. I am your host, Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on family.